laws and mechanical systems development and design of all the mechanical systems on three stages, exclusive of ground support. I was not involved, our organization was not involved in ground support in women, it was handled by a different organization. And, you know, many people consider the rocket engine as a propulsion system. And, of course, it is only a component or a subsystem like anything else. In our case, we handle the liquid where it enters, you know, the stage, and then through the whole process of propulsive activities. And then even after it has left, you know, our problem consisted, especially with the first clustered rocket engines, also in the thermal protection of the base, which was at that time a complete novelty. You know, in a single engine, you don't have this problem. But as soon as you have two engines or three engines, and at altitude, your exhaust expands, and then, you know, it actually impinges, and then you get the at the point of impingement, you get a stagnation pressure, and you get backward flow, and this backward flow is, of course, is full of energy, and you have either radiative heat transfer or you have convective heat transfer, and depending on altitude, I mean, the contributions of convective heat transfer and radiative heat transfer change. And there is, of course, again, a difference between a liquid hydrogen oxygen engine and an oxygen kerosene engine, because the liquid hydrogen has a cleaner combustion, and you do not have the SUD particles which contribute a lot to radiation.
This problem of impingement, is that why there was so much
then you had to
question about clustering in the first place? Was that an argument against it?
No, it was not an argument against it, but it was a problem which had never been treated before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what I wanted to tell you is it is our problem, our name was propulsion, but it is not only the rocket engine, it is all the other systems, like loading, then propellant management within the tank, pressurization of the tank, then all the flow dynamics, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Then the preconditioning, so that the turbines did not burn up, that was a problem. Where the people did not believe us, and then they burned up the they burned up the turbine blades.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to give you an idea, the initial requirement for liquid oxygen consisted of an accuracy at these cryogenic temperatures within 5 or 6 or 7 degrees Fahrenheit. And now, of course, you can come up with a big cooler or whatever it is, and we solved this entirely different by helium injection. Have you ever lived in a dry country, out in New Mexico or in Arizona? And you know, they have just the evaporative cooler. You have the square box, Excelsior, and you have a fan, and you draw the dry air through it, and by evaporating your water, you know, you take out the heat of your air, and what you get into your room is a nice, cool flow of air.
Mm-hmm.
And we used a similar principle. That means we used helium, which has, of course, a critical pressure and critical temperature different from oxygen.
Mm.
And, of course, it has the property that oxygen, liquid oxygen, can evaporate into gaseous helium. And then you get the same effect as in Arizona, with a desert. And I think we introduced this method, which was very elegant, it was very cheap and inexpensive, extremely precise and elegant and reliable, you know. And what we did is you have to cool below the required temperature. And you have to know your history, because after you stop injecting helium, then you allow the liquid to heat up again, and you get plenty of ambient heat into your suction line. And then we established this heat transfer and had then over time a precise time. So we knew exactly how many minutes prior to the actual start we had to shut off the heat. You know, we could not have it too cool and could not have it too hot. And as I said, the tolerance was around 5 or 7 degrees Fahrenheit. Mm. That is just one of these items. Mm-hmm. You do not want to overpressurize your tanks and blow off during flight your oxygen vapor or your hydrogen vapor. So we started out very early in 1954. Isn't some of you gentlemen from Michigan, University of Michigan, is it?
No, I'm from Wisconsin.
Oh, from Wisconsin.
Yeah.
we had the University of Ann Arbor.
Mm-hmm.
And at this time it was Gordon Van der Weyl, if you have. He wrote a book on thermodynamics, and later on it was John Clark. We asked him to come up with a mathematical model of all the heat and mass transfer in the Ullrich space of a cryogen. Mm. And I think this university did outstanding work in laying the groundwork for later math models and computer programs which allowed us to fairly accurately predict and handle this problem. You know, either you have too much pressure in it. Now let me ask one question. If I am talking about a subject which is not, familiar with you, then please tell me so.
Okay.
Because I might otherwise talk and not communicate.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I expect you to ask questions. If you. So you either went off, which is poor engineering, or if you do not supply enough of this pressurant, you get a pressure decay. And if you have pressure decay, then your pumps start to cavitate. Mm. And you have no orderly flow anymore into your rocket chamber. And the performance and also the temperature control very much depends on the mixture ratio. So if you, feed in too much oxygen, then you get excessive gas generator temperatures and you burn your turbines. Or if you do not feed enough in, then your temperatures are too low, you do not get the performance and the thrust. So these things have to be handled very carefully. And one of these requirements is to provide the proper Ullrich pressure, so that the inlet conditions at the pump are satisfied and that you get flow without excessive cavitation. And you get a controlled, predictable flow into your pumps and into your combustion chamber.
Can you use nitrogen to get this Ullrich pressure?
No. You see, at the end of the propulsive period, all these big containers are filled with a pressurant.
Mm-hmm.
They are filled with a pressurant. And in a rocket, you have to have the inert mass as small as possible. All you want to have is, in an ideal rocket, 100% propellants. So you have to have first a low pressure to reduce its weight, and in a big container that can amount to thousands of pounds. Furthermore, you want to have also a high temperature in order to make your residual gas weight and the mass light.
Mm-hmm.
And these two conditions you have to fulfill. Now from this point of view, of course, you would like to use hydrogen because it has the lowest molecular weight, but it is not compatible with oxygen. So the next one is helium, but helium is expensive and you have to store it all, you know, either cryogenically or under high pressure. And we looked into all these systems and it must be reliable. So what we did, and this is nothing new, we evaporated liquid oxygen and used the exhaust or the jet, you know, in a dual function.
Mm-hmm.
By either winding a coil in the around the thrust chamber, as we did it on the RL-10, or by using the turbine exhaust across the heat exchanger, and then evaporating your liquid oxygen, and you know the volume increases almost by 3 orders of magnitude. Mm. You can, if you have 1 liter and you evaporate it, you can get as much as 800 or 900 liters. This is what we want, mm-hmm. and at the proper temperature. But if you come into the outage space, it's very cold in there, and if you heat it too high, you do not get the temperature. You know, your heat is lost. That means you have to have a heavy heat exchanger, and you do not get a benefit out of it. You do not want to be too cold either, because otherwise your residual pressure on does, a remaining pressure on in the terminal phase is too heavy. Mm-hmm. So you have to optimize all these conditions.
How did you reach this optimization? Through flight testing or through model testing here then?
No. First of all, you can use a simple equation of state. This is how we started out in Peenemünde. You know, then you find out, oh, there are other phenomena. And then you try to refine. Mm-hmm. And of course, one way is you over-dimension it, roughly, let me say, 5 or 10%, and blow it off through your vent valve, which is not very refined engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And oxygen, you never like it in anywhere, because if you have too much oxygen, you know, if you discharge it into the base area, then it combines with your unburned fuel, which is used in the gas generator to cool your working fluid for the turbine.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you discharge oxygen, that there is always a way for these gases to find somehow a loophole into the base area, and it aggravates base heating, so you don't want it.
Why didn't you use liquid hydrogen in the first stage?
Oh, this is a simple question. In the first stage, hydrogen is too voluminous. You know, the density is too low.
Mm-hmm.
The density of hydrogen is roughly 1/12 of that of water, or roughly an order of magnitude lower than that of oxygen. And it takes a very voluminous tank to house or to contain a kilogram or a pound of hydrogen. And in the earlier years, the structural design methods and the materials available were not as refined as they are today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you have to have such a voluminous booster stage, all your other equipment, the transportation, you know, shipping it, your barge, or your launch tower has to be increased accordingly, and you know, this is not very convenient.
And when you can't, so when you get into
now, let me come back to the pressure, and we can discuss this later.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the simplest way is to use your propellants as pressurants, and you don't have to have an additional auxiliary storage system and so forth. Since you have, if you have a pump-fed system, you get the pressure for free anyhow. So all you have to do is, on the high pressure side, you tap off and feed it through a heat exchanger. You use your exhaust heat from the turbine or from the main jet, and then you have your pressure. And that is a very simple system. And if your analysis is accurate and everything, all it takes is a little orifice, a control orifice. That's all that is required.
Mm.
Plus the heat exchanger.
Pardon?
Plus the heat exchanger.
The heat exchangers, that's correct. But I mean, you don't have to have a control valve, you don't have to have a shut-off valve, you don't have to have a fill valve, and you don't have to have an extra high-pressure container.
Mm-hmm.
And all you have to provide cryogenic storage, like in the S1C, where the helium was inside the tank. There is no accessibility, you cannot inspect it afterwards, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you use oxygen from the oxygen pump, and feed it through a simple orifice in the heat exchanger, that is the simplest system you can think of, and the most reliable, of course.
Mm.
Now, in a hydrogen system, you cannot find a better pressure than hydrogen, because it has the lowest molecular weight. So that is self-evident.
Mm-hmm.
for a hydrogen tank. Hydrogen, you use hydrogen as a pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And there could only be one question: why not helium? Helium is lighter than oxygen, but you have to store it either under very high pressure,
mm-hmm.
at room temperature, and that requires a heavy container at 3,000 PSI or something like this. And you have to have all the required hardware, the valves and so forth. And then you have to have the lines, the connectors, that can cause you a lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And we found out that if you make a thorough, a careful analysis, your helium system is actually not lighter than an oxygen system. And if you dimension it and design it and develop it right, your oxygen system is so much simpler and is not heavier. As a matter of fact, there was one stage which had a helium system that was much, much heavier than a comparable oxygen system. They used flash evaporation. You know, instead of a heat exchanger, they discharged it into a lower pressure and then allowed oxygen? Or what? Now let me see, I might be wrong. They used helium for pre-pressurization only, for pre-pressurization, that is something different, yeah. But other helium systems in missiles and so on were heavier than oxygen systems. A helium was also used for pre-pressurization because we found your heat exchanger during the transient startup does not come up in a square wave fashion to full pressure. It takes time. But it is more like an S-shaped curve.
Mm.
And during this time, where you need it most, you know, you get a pressure drop. In order to avoid this pressure drop, we used helium pre-pressurization to keep the pressure constant. And it turned out that the helium blanket somehow served as an insulation blanket. It avoided condensation of the pressure and gas into liquid again. You know, your first portion of oxygen gas, which evaporates during transient, is not very much superheated. So if it comes into the container and hits the surface, it condenses. It shrinks its volume, and this causes this pressure, which is not very nice, because it happens at a time where you have to accelerate the liquid column in your suction line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if you have a slight overpressure, your column has to be accelerated. And during this acceleration, you run into pressure decays or into lower pressures. Only after you have steady state and the pressure recovers and comes up to the desired level. Did I make this clear?
I think so.
Okay.
Fortunately, we'll be able to go back and read the transcript again because, you know, you introduce a lot of things here. We'll have to go back and trace it.
Now, I might go to too much detail. You have to tell me what you are interested in because
I
think
this level of detail is good.
This is fine.
Yeah.
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 We want to get this.
Now, if you want to... You know, I might quote some things not exactly as it should be formalized or defined, you know, and all these things, they should be refined and made as precise as possible.
Could you tell us something of the history of these systems? We're interested in kind of how things were done on the Redstone and Jupiter programs, and then how this technology was carried over into the Saturn program. Do you have any examples of that that you could talk about?
Of course, the Redstone, and I think it was a very wise move on the part of North American at that time, Rocketdyne.
Mm-hmm.
They try to understand and to build as much as possible according to the V2.
Mm-hmm.
And after they had their feet on the ground, of course, they didn't stop there, which was wise too. And then from there on, they refined. And one area is a power generation for the pump feed system, you know, the turbine.
Mm-hmm.
In a V2, you used hydrogen peroxide under pressurization. And the hydrogen peroxide was decomposed. And then it operated the turbine, roughly 600 horsepower. That was, I would say, one of the seven wonders of the world at this time to produce steam power in a diameter like this, you know, and 600 horsepower, that was never done before.
Mm-hmm.
And without it, I mean, you couldn't have never have come to a pump fed system because of the horsepower requirement.
Mm-hmm.
And at this time, the gas turbine was not in existence. It was developed secretly, I mean, for the military. But in the early phases of rocketry, the gas turbine technology was in an awful state. There were so many fakes, and everyone, every so often a guy came up, you know, and claimed his gas turbine would work, but never did. And only, I mean, with the military planes, with a jet plane, that was a time when the first gas turbine was developed.
Mm-hmm.
And but this technology was not available to us in the rocket. Rocket development. So hydrogen peroxide was all right.
Mm-hmm.
But then later on, you know, you wanted to refine, you wanted to improve, you wanted to simplify. Why an extra working fluid?
Mm-hmm.
So the Redstone still used hydrogen peroxide.
Mm-hmm.
But then came the military system, that was a Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
And for this purpose, you used then your propellants, fuel-rich, in order to keep the temperatures low. You cannot burn it at the same mixture ratio as in the main chamber because the temperatures are too high. You are around 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And, no material exists for turbines and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the highest they have in experimental jet engines at the present time is around 2,000, 2,300 and so forth. Experimental,
yeah.
Not operational,
yeah.
But you have to cool your blades and you have to resort to all kinds of tricks and so forth. I do not know how reliable it is, but of course higher temperatures help a great deal because of the improved thermal cycles and so forth. You get reduced fuel consumption, so especially in the jet plane, jet engine. So this material did not exist at this time. Then in a rocket you don't have any air if you are at high altitude, so you cannot cool with air like a jet engine can. Or a different way had to be found, and this was to burn the mixture fuel rich. And as a matter of fact, I had built a little gas generator already in Peenemünde, and we call it the sud blower. We run roughly 5 or 6 tests. It used also the propellants of the V2. It was oxygen, liquid oxygen, and alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we did it, we just injected water, and brought the temperature down. Of course, it was not necessary since the alcohol contained at that time anyhow 25% water. It would have been simpler just to add the water to the alcohol and bring the alcohol down to 50 proof or 100 proof. That's what it is.
Yeah.
And but this was a little gas generator, roughly the size of it's a little bit smaller than your tape recorder here.
Uh-huh.
And we ran several tests. We got the pressure, we got the temperature, we got the steam. But then came the mass production of the V2, 1,000 rockets a month. And whatever was not ready or didn't have enough promise to be finally utilized, you know, that had all to be stopped and had to be discovered. So we didn't do this.
What was this gas generator of yours called?
It was, of course, a camouflaged name because all these things
mm-hmm.
were secret during the war. We called it the sud blower, you know.
S-U-T?
S-O-O-T. Sud, like the sud from
okay.
the
okay.
from the chimney
oh,
or
yeah.
a
uh-huh.
smokestack, sud
yeah.
blower, you know.
Yeah.
So gave it a fancy name,
yeah.
sud blower.
Yeah.
So, you know, what I wanted to say is you wanted to know the history of
mm-hmm.
all this stuff. And at the same time, in 1943, we had another concept that was not to use, let me say, a fuel-rich mixture and then exhaust it only very poorly propulsively used. There was one concept which used, again, hydrogen peroxide and compressed it to very high pressures, as a matter of fact, to pressures above the combustion chamber pressure, like in the high-pressure engine we are building right now. And then this high-pressure pump discharged it at, let me say, if the combustion pressure was 15 atmospheres, this hydrogen peroxide pump discharged the hydrogen peroxide at 100 atmospheres, decomposed it at this pressure roughly, expanded across a turbine, and then this turbine exhaust was expanded into the combustion chamber, right, close to the injector phase. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you utilize a gas or vapor or whatever it is, or a combustion product mixture at high pressures and high temperatures, you know, from your Mollier chart, from your IS diagram, you get a much better utilization than if you do this at a lower pressure. With other words, in some of our rocket engines, the turbine working fluid was generated in a parallel flow and exhausted parallel to the main jet. And what happened here is you did it in series, upstream from the chamber. Is that clear what mm-hmm. I am saying? Mm-hmm. Upstream. In series. You know that on an F1 engine, I guess we dump 500 pounds per second of unburned kerosene from the turbine exhaust. It's a pretty big number.
Yeah.
And I guess
yeah.
if I would have an oil well giving me 500 pounds per second of unburned kerosene, I would be a rich man. Very fast.
Yeah.
Now, this fuel-rich exhaust is undesirable. But fortunately, the high-pressure engine, which does the same thing as a concept I try to describe to you, which produces the turbine working fluid upstream in series to the main
mm-hmm.
chamber, does away with this, because everything will be optimally reacted in the combustion chamber for optimum propulsion efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
Was it too much? Was it too fast? Or if you cannot follow, let
no,
me know.
What?
I have a few sketches of this stuff. Maybe I can give this to you later on. I don't know how you handle it.
Yeah, we would appreciate having sketches if you can.
And you said you were interested in the historical development, and
mm-hmm.
I think
right.
this was done by Mr. Perlman, was his name. Perlman. He handled this, what we would today call the high pressure feed system principle and concept.
How would you spell that, please?
Poehlmann. Now he's dead now. He doesn't live anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now what I have given you was very incoherent. You know, I am sorry that we take a fraction here and then we jump into another area. If you don't mind, I don't mind.
No.
But
we can, if we run into a problem, we can call back later.
What I had on my mind was to discuss a little bit the generation of turbopump power, because it was a problem. You know, in the
mm-hmm.
beginning, this hydrogen peroxide solved the problem, because you had only a small decomposer this size, and it produced 600 horsepower. If you would do this with a conventional steam plant, you would have needed a big boiler and a big building and what have you. You couldn't have done it.
That always amazes me, the horsepower rating of some of the turbo pumps. How
now,
do you get this?
In the F1, we have 65,000 by one engine. And in the whole cluster, we have five times that is more than a quarter billion horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
That is 330,000 horsepower. And in the S1C, just for feeding the propeller. After the, I try to discuss the V2, the hydrogen peroxide power generation for the turbine, and I told you that the Redstone, which was the first larger rocket here, used the same concept.
Mm-hmm.
sort of concept, except that Rocketdyne improved it to a solid catalyst. You know, in Peenemünde, in the V2, you had two liquids, mm-hmm. which you used for gargling. No kidding,
yeah.
You know. Hydrogen peroxide, of course, the ladies use for bleaching and blonding their hair, and you use it for disinfecting. Mm-hmm. And then it was chlorium permanganate, magnesium permanganate, that is, it was some kind of a reddish salt, and I know.
Potassium permanganate?
Potassium permanganate, is that
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And you use it also for disinfecting wounds.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it makes a crimson-like
mm-hmm.
Color and water and so forth.